journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
We all mind. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, October 30, 2007, and for Sonali, I'm Aura Bogado.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Failing to recognize the Armenian genocide, a hard look at New York's real ID, and graffiti and a mystery at the LA River.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the fellow meadows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. I'm Aura Bogado. Congressional supporters of an Armenian genocide recognition bill put off a vote last week on the measure as pressure mounted from Turkish officials and the Bush administration. Democratic Congressman and bill co-sponsor Adam Schiff was the lead author of a letter that stated that the resolution would be brought up at a more opportune occasion, quote, sometime later this year or in 2008. Upon the bill's passage through the House of Foreign Affairs Committee earlier this month, Turkey withdrew its ambassador to the U.S. and warned that a vote on the resolution could hamper relations between the two countries, thus impairing U.S. military operations in Iraq. Bush administration officials weighed in against passing the recognition bill as the delay on the vote followed. Considered the first genocide of the 20th century, the Ottoman Turkish government began a systematic campaign of arrests, deportations, and annihilation against the Armenian people on April 24, 1915. By 1923, mass killings had claimed the lives of an estimated 1.5 million Armenians. To this day, the Turkish government continues to deny that the genocide ever took place, and despite numerous nations recognizing the Armenian genocide, the United States, after 92 years, has yet to officially recognize it. Despite the lack of official federal acknowledgement, 40 U.S. states have recognized that genocide, as has the International Association of Genocide Scholars. We're joined in studio by Zanko Armenian. He's on the board of directors for the Western Region Armenian National Committee of America. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning.
I want to go back to 1915 because 1.5 million Armenians, that's quite a heavy sum. And although I think some of our listeners are familiar with the genocide, can you talk about what took place through this genocide?
Sure. At that time, the government in power was the Ottoman Turkish government, different from today's Republic of Turkey. And the Armenian population lived in what is primarily considered eastern Turkey today, bordering Armenia to the east, Iran and Syria to the south, and Georgia north of Armenia. Essentially, in April of 1915, the Turkish government, the Young Turk government at the time, ordered that the community leaders be rounded up and executed, and that all men be sent to the front lines of what was happening at that time, which was World War One. So under the guise of World War One, essentially, the entire population in what is today eastern Turkey was cleansed, was marched south either to the Syrian desert or executed. And so if you go there today, what you see is thousands upon thousands of centuries-old Armenian churches that sit there decaying with no real population there except primarily the Turkey's present-day Kurdish minority population.
Now, this isn't a genocide that's actually in dispute. We've been talking about this House bill right now, and although Turkey continues to deny it, most people here in the U.S., including lawmakers, don't say that a genocide didn't occur, correct?
Yeah. At this point, the Turkish government is isolated on this issue. They're the only government, really, that is denying the facts of the genocide in a rather, vehement way. They continue a campaign every year where they pay public relations firms millions of dollars in this country and around the world to essentially try and rewrite the historical truth. But 40, as you mentioned earlier in the program, 40 U.S. states have already acknowledge the genocide. You've got dozens of countries, over a dozen countries in Europe and around the world who have recognized the genocide, and all reputable scholars, especially those who specialize in genocide scholarship, recognize the facts of the Armenian genocide.
Now, Israel, of all countries, joins the U.S. in failing to recognize the genocide, and even though there's these historical connections, obviously, between the Holocaust and the genocide against the Armenian people. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a very unfortunate situation, unfortunately, because Israel considers Turkey a close ally for political expediency purposes. They continue a very short-sighted policy of undermining their own moral credibility on this issue of all countries by supporting the Turkish government in fighting this sort of resolution, instead of saying, Turkey, you know, we want to be allies with you, we value our partnership. However, on this moral issue, we're going to differ with you. We would encourage you to come to terms with your past. Same with the U.S. Congress. You would think that our country, of all country, which has built the Turkish economy and built the Turkish military with our taxpayer dollars, would have the moral courage to say, we are going to remain true to our own values and principles in this country by acknowledging the genocide. We would ask you to stop your campaign of denial. It's really not in your long-term interest as a nation.
Yeah, and there's the moral argument, and there's also the face of human rights and the United States being a leader in the world, and these kinds of blocks towards recognizing what's clearly a genocide really seems to undermine the U.S.'s role in human rights.
It really does, and this resolution really goes beyond just recognizing the Armenian genocide. It's really meant to set our own foreign policy in alignment with our own values of human rights, asking that the U.S. foreign policy properly reflect the principles of human rights and recognizing genocide and affirming the truth about the Armenian genocide, our own U.S. records about that. And really, this is about the U.S. credibility in the region and in the world. By passing this resolution, it would send the signal around the world that not only on this issue, but on all issues having to do with genocide, genocide is something that we do not deny. Genocide is something we speak about openly because we are against it. It is against our principles as a nation. And that would go a long way to begin restoring our credibility in the world, and especially in that region where we have so many troops.
Turkey's ambassador to the U.S., Nabi Sensoy, says energy should be focused on reconciliation between Turks and Armenians. But can that really happen without recognition?
The first step in reconciliation is proper recognition of the truth and the historical record on this. By continuing their campaign of denial, they're showing that they are not approaching this issue in good faith and are actually working against the interests of their own people. This is not about the Armenian people versus, you know, the Turkish people. This is about a current Turkish government that is acting more like its Ottoman predecessors than a responsible Western nation, a democratic nation that it claims to be. And instead of coming to terms with their own historical past, they continue to spend money on this really endless game of denial that undermines the future of their own nation.
We're speaking with Zanku Armenian. He's on the board of directors for the Western Region Armenian National Committee of America. Now, let's talk about the political chess piece in play with this most recent delay on recognizing the Armenian genocide in terms of the Iraq War, because this is a historical issue, right? This is something that happened 92 years ago. It's yet to be recognized by the U.S. Turkey is basically threatening that if this passes the House, and this is recognized by lawmakers, then that's going to mean a different situation in Iraq.
Yeah, essentially, unfortunately, Turkey on the one hand claims to be one of our greatest allies in the region, but yet on the other hand uses the Iraq War to threaten and blackmail our U.S. Congress in not speaking about this issue by essentially exporting their own Article 301 and imposing a gag order on our own Congress. They claimed that, you know, our own Pentagon would claim that, well, we really need Turkey in terms of the current Iraq war. and that, you know, it creates tensions. They create situations on the ground by moving forces to the Iraqi border to deal with their what they claim is their Kurdish problem. And the reality is so here we are, the genocide resolution has been postponed for the time being, but they are making incursions into Iraq today. They are bombing northern Iraq today in Kurdish positions. So they are already destabilizing that region without the resolution even going anywhere. So clearly that's a false argument on their part, that trying to connect all these things together. And it's very unfortunate that our own Department of Defense and State Department have fallen victim to this lie.
Now, besides Turkey and the Bush administration, there's a lot of money and lobbyists in Washington. What's going on with that in terms of pressuring lawmakers to stay away from this resolution?
Yeah, it's a money and the influence of lobbyists is unfortunately a fact of life in our U.S. government and in Congress. The Turkish government today, just to name a few of them, they employ DLA Piper, which is one of the largest law firms, which has Dick Gephardt, former congressman from Missouri, former majority leader in the Democratic Party, lobbying heavily against this resolution. The irony on that one is that Congressman Dick Gephardt, when he was a congressman, actually was a co-sponsor of this resolution for years and years. So here he is with, you know, just a few dollar bills have turned him on this issue. You've got the Livingston Group, which is Bob Livingston, former Speaker of the House designate in the when the Republicans controlled Congress. He's on a contract. Fleischman Hillard, notorious Fleischman Hillard, which is known for fleecing our own government here in the city of Los Angeles just a few years ago. Their Washington office works heavily on this issue as well. And each of these firms make over $1 million a year in lobbying for the government of Turkey on this issue.
Now, what are the prospects for tabling the resolution at a later time? Adam Schiff, in this letter that he wrote, said that it might be voted on later in the year or maybe in 2008. But aren't the conditions probably going to be the same? Wouldn't we still see the same arguments for not passing the recognition bill?
I think we've been hearing the same arguments for decades on this resolution. The reality is that the resolution is not dead. It is standing there, and it is valid, can be brought to the House floor at any time that this Congress is in session, which is all the way through the end of 2008. Speaker Pelosi is firmly committed to the issue, and as are the chief sponsors and over, 211 co-sponsors, which actually, if you listen to the general media reports about this, you would think that this thing is failing, but the reality is quite the opposite. There, out of 3,000 resolutions in the U.S. Congress, only 33 of them have this level of support, despite the Turkish government and all their paid lobbyists throwing millions of dollars at this issue and throwing everything they had at this issue in the last couple of weeks since the House Foreign Affairs Committee vote on October 10th. We're still standing strong with 211 co-sponsors. We will be seeking to increase that number again, and at the appropriate time, we'll bring this resolution to the floor for a full vote. I anticipate that will be in 2008, and the interesting scenario there is that 2008 is also when the entire House of Representatives comes up for election. So the political landscape is quite dynamic during that period of time, and I foresee that this will be brought to the House floor successfully when we reaffirm all the votes that we have on our side of the issue.
What are you asking folks to do in terms of pressuring their lawmakers to move this bill forward?
I think it's important that we all speak up to our representatives and become active on this issue, because this is not just about recognizing the Armenian genocide. Just by the mere fact of all these lobbyists and the Bush administration and the State Department and the Pentagon all aligning their forces on this issue, trying to essentially put a gag order on this issue, the importance of people speaking up and asking that we speak out with moral authority, we affirm our own American values on this issue, that's what this bill is about. Asking your congressman or congresswoman to co-sponsor this and support it when it comes to the House floor on the vote is essentially saying we want you to stay true to our own American values.
Zanku, thank you so much for coming in studio and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Zanku Armenian. He's on the board of directors for the Western Region Armenian National Committee of America. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a hard look at the Real ID. That's after today's Radical Day in History.
Hello, I'm Terry McNally. People are swamped. Too much content, not enough context. On Free Forum, Tuesdays at noon, it's my job to seek out, sort through, and bring back what matters. I talk to people with pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, even spirit, based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. That's Free Forum, Tuesdays at noon on KPFK 90.7 FM, streaming at kpfk.org.
This is War Radio Roots reporter Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 30th in 1973, the Pacifica radio station WBAI aired a monologue called Filthy Words, done by the comedian George Carlin. In his routine, Carlin listed and made fun of the seven dirty words, words which cannot now be uttered over public airwaves. Apparently, a complaint was filed with the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC. Although this was the only complaint filed, it eventually landed the Pacifica Foundation in a Supreme Court case against the FCC. The final ruling was in favor of the FCC, and it established many restrictions on the content of publicly broadcast material. Although these indecency rules apply to all American media outlets, the penalties and fines are much more damaging to community radio stations such as the Pacifica stations, who aren't funded by corporate advertising. How unfortunate. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Aura Bogado. New York Governor Eliot Spitzer has announced a three-tier driver's license system that includes compliance with the federal Real ID Act. Reversing an earlier one driver's license for all proposal, the governor's recent decision received sound condemnation from various groups. Real ID critics said the state driver's licenses would effectively be turned into a national ID card through the plan. Concerns over privacy issues and implementation costs to the state were also cited. The regulations for Real ID compliant licenses have not been finalized, and the program is not set to be phased in nationally until 2013. Spitzer hopes to see his plan take effect next year. Aside from privacy and fiscal concerns, the issue has also provoked both sides of the immigration debate. Anti-immigrant groups take issue with a third-tier driver's license that would be made available to undocumented immigrants. Meanwhile, pro-immigrant rights organizations believe that the third-tier license would make undocumented immigrants more exposed by creating a list of such persons that the federal government would seek access to. A joint statement released by the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium said the system would make undocumented immigrants, quote, vulnerable to discrimination and harassment. We're joined on the line by S.J. Jung. He's the president of the Young Korean American Service and Education Center in New York. Welcome to Uprising.
Hello. How are you?
Great. How are you doing this morning?
It's getting cold here in New York, but Governor Spitzer's recent change certainly made the weather even feel more colder.
Yeah. Mm. Now, SJ, you've worked on a coalition for immigration rights to driver's licenses in New York with the DMV. Can you tell us a little bit about that coalition, what its aims were? And,
I am with YKSEC. YKSEC stands for Young Korean American Service and Education Center in Flushing, New York. And YKSEC is a New York affiliate of NACSEC, the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium. At the same time, our organization, YKSEC, is one of four steering committee members of the coalition that we created to bring about the policy change on the driver license issue in New York. This coalition was created like 4 years ago, and we have worked so far very hard to bring about the policy change on driver licensing in New York. And as you know, about a month ago, Governor Spitzer finally came out and he made an announcement on the policy change on the driver license issue, and we applauded his leadership and courage. But unfortunately, he has shown such a shocking flip-flopping a couple of days ago, and now we have to deal with a new situation here.
Before we get into Governor Spitzer, I want to talk a little bit more about the coalition. Can you talk about the practical policies that you were seeking in terms of driver's licenses in New York?
Yeah, the coalition consists of about 65 different community organizations in New York. And what we really have been calling for is basically one license for all policy in New York. As you have already introduced in the backgrounder, one license for all policy can make our roads safer, and also it can make our state and our nation even more secure. If you deny access to driver licenses, especially to undocumented immigrants, I think we have to be very realistic. Do you think they will stop driving all of a sudden? No. Especially when their livelihood is on the line, especially when they're dealing with an emergency, they still drive, even without license, even without auto insurance. That means more accidents and higher insurance premium. So that's why we have been calling for one license for all policy in New York so that even undocumented immigrants will have access to driver's license. And once again, about a month ago, Governor Spitzer came through. He made an announcement that New York will provide access to driver's licenses regardless of immigration status. That was a practical policy. I don't think that was a policy which would benefit only immigrants, but I think that was a practical policy that would have been a benefit for all New Yorkers. If the plan just went ahead as originally announced, then all New Yorkers were able to benefit from this policy. For example, we will have a less accident on the road because almost every driver will have access to driver's license, so no one will drive without a driver's license. And at the same time, it was estimated that about $120 million saving in insurance premium for all New Yorkers, because the insurance premium for unlicensed motorists will go down by 34%. So once again, this was a practical policy which was good for all New Yorkers. That's why our coalition has pushed for this policy. It was not just a self-centered issue, which would be only good for the immigrant community. But unfortunately, Governor Spitzer succumbed to misguided opposition and anti-immigrant rhetoric. And he has forsaken a practical policy that would have benefited all New Yorkers for short-sighted political cover.
Now, originally, anti-immigrant groups were angry that everyone was going to get the same license. Now they're saying that they're angry that undocumented immigrants would still be granted a third-tier license. What is the about-face about for Governor Spitzer? Why did he just change his mind on this?
Yeah, once again, as I said just a second ago, he has succumbed to misguided opposition and anti-immigrant rhetoric. And by signing on to this, another disaster called Real ID, Governor Spitzer has also contradicted himself. When he made an announcement about a month ago that New York State will provide access to driver's license regardless of immigration status, he already assured us that New York State's new driver's license policy would make us safer because of its new security measures, like its new document verification system, computerized photo comparison technology, and anti-fraud measures. And you know what? Each license under this new plan, each license application would have been subjected to a tough and lengthy security check, similar to what we do for passports. So, before this policy change, actually, you go to the DMV and you can get the driver license right away, right? But because of this new policy, it was going to take at least 4 to 6 weeks process each application for driver license. So, about a month ago, Governor Spitzer came out and say, if we implement this new policy, this will make our roads a lot safer, and at the same time, this policy will make us more secure because we can bring undocumented immigrants out of shadow into the system, and it's better provide access to a driver's license to those undocumented immigrants so that we can make our state more secure. But now he has succumbed to this misguided opposition and anti-immigrant rhetoric because, unfortunately, right after he made an announcement on this new policy change, The first one who came out with a criticism was, unfortunately, Mayor Bloomberg. Mayor Bloomberg came out and say, you know, he had some concerns over this new policy. And he started spreading misinformation on this policy, saying that if we provide driver licenses to undocumented immigrants, then even undocumented immigrants may be able to register as voters, and they may even be able to cast a vote, which is absolutely wrong. Which is absolutely wrong, you know, because driver license has nothing to do with the voter registration.
Right.
And if his argument has any merit, then you should not issue driver license even to those legal residents, you know, even those green card holders. They are not supposed to vote. And if you are really afraid of anyone who's trying to, vote, any non-citizen who's trying to cast his or her vote, then you should not even issue driver license to permanent residents, you know.
Right.
So it was really Mayor Bloomberg's comment was very negative, and it was really had no merit. But unfortunately, some other politicians followed. For example, Anthony Weiner, a Democrat congressman. And a lot of people believe that he will be the next mayor of New York City. And Anthony Weiner also came out say, Governor Spitzer's policy has legitimate problems. Legitimate problems. So one after another, the politicians came out, you know, they were just joining the anti-immigrant bandwagon. And then the Republicans, they try to pass a legislation at state Senate, as they actually did, you know. In an attempt to overturn this policy. So there was a mounting political pressure on Governor Spitzer, and unfortunately, he's no Bush. He was not able to stay the course, and he has succumbed to misguided opposition and anti-immigrant rhetoric. And here we go. Now, New York State will be the first one who's going to implement the REAL ID Act, which is even worse than any other policy related to driver's license.
And we will see, I imagine, more states following suit. I want to remind our listeners that we're joined on the line by S.J. Jung. He's the president of the Young Korean American Service and Education Center in New York. We're talking about New York Governor Eliot Spitzer's announcement for a three-tier driver's license system that includes compliance with the Federal ID Act. I want to talk to you a little bit about the regulatory standards because they seem very vague.
Excuse me?
The regulatory standards in terms of who's going to get which license. It seems very...
Yeah. Now we are going to have three different kinds of licenses in New York. The citizens will have access to what we call Real ID. And then they will, with Real ID, they'll be able to drive their cars, and then they can also use it when they board the airplane or enters federal buildings. But for those who cannot prove and show their immigration status, they'll be entitled to New York State driver's license, but which will unfortunately be marked, as not for U.S. government purposes on the card, which means that they cannot use it when they board the airplane or enters into the building, federal buildings. They can only use it when they want to drive a car. And this policy, some people, especially anti-immigrant forces, they argue that this multi-tier system will will strengthen the security and will increase the security of this country, but unfortunately not. Because, with this policy, undocumented immigrants will be very afraid, and they will not be able to come out and apply for this discriminatory license, because the license will be labeled as not for U.S. government purposes, and only those undocumented immigrants will use them, actually, because as time goes by, more and more people will go for the Real ID, and only those undocumented immigrants will use New York State driver's license. And once again, the anti-immigrant force always claim that this multi-tiered licensing system will make our state, our nation safer and more secured, but that is absolutely wrong. Because now, about 4% of our total population in this country are undocumented immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about 4%, okay, 13 million people. And, finding a terrorist is just like finding a needle in a haystack. So if you really want to find a terrorist, right, The first thing you have to do, we have to reduce the haystack. But if you push all those undocumented immigrants further into the shadows of the society and deny them of access to driver's license, and you don't even know who they are, where they are, you know, you don't even know what they're doing, then it'll be much, much tougher to find any terrorists, because terrorists will hide themselves in a larger haystack. And actually, this is a policy that the terrorists would love, actually, because they will find a better chance of hiding themselves in a much larger haystack. So once again, either multi-tiered licensing system or complete denial of any access to driver license to undocumented immigrants, both policy is very bad and both policy are wrong, and it does not really help strengthen our security.
SJ, can you talk to us a little bit about some of the costs that are involved? Because individuals are now going to have to pay something like $100 to even get a driver's license, and the state will also be absorbing a lot of money in yet another bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, Governor Spitzer made an announcement with Mike Chertoff, and he said that the New York State will implement the Real ID, and you just mentioned the cost, and cost is also a concern. Because according to National Governors Association, and also according to National Conference of State Legislature, Real ID cost $11 billion, right? $11 billion. And don't be surprised, this is not a funded mandate. There is no money assigned for the implementation of Real ID. And we are talking about $11 billion for nothing, okay? And Governor Spitzer has not only given up his principles, but also his fiscal discipline by announcing the implementation of Real ID, even with no funding. We are talking about $11 billion, and which is totally unworkable.
And finally, can you talk to us a little bit about the dangers that it poses to people's privacy and identity security, because seven states have already passed laws against implementing the Real ID, and an additional 10 states have passed resolutions calling on Congress to repeal the Real ID Act.
Yeah, as you said, actually 17 states have already passed the legislation opposing the Real ID, because Real ID has so many problems, you know. It's cost and also implementation problems and privacy concerns and civil rights issues. Real ID actually, you know, let me put it this way. Real ID creates Big Brother, and Real ID destroys real life. And Real ID will create America's first national identity card, and Real ID will enable the routine tracking of individuals. Now Big Brother will monitor what we do and where we go, you know. And eventually the Real ID will propel us towards a surveillance society. If you love Big Brother, go ahead, support Real ID. If you're opposed to Big Brother, then Real ID is not your choice. Real ID cannot be a solution. Real ID cannot be an answer for national security either, you know. And let me put it this way. We're talking about $11 billion to be spent on the implementation of Real ID. And as I said, Real ID is an empty policy. It will do nothing to strengthen our security, and it's totally unworkable. So those people who believe in Real ID, they're really trying to do something like this, you know. When you try to catch a fly, you don't want to spend a lot of money in developing an atomic bomb. And the Real ID will do exactly that. And, you know, they will spend a lot of money in developing something like an atomic bomb just in order to catch a fly, and they will actually explode it. We are taking a gigantic step towards a surveillance society, and the Real ID, we should be opposed to this very bad legislation. Some people call it an anti-immigrant legislation, but I say this is very un-American, you know. I mean, whether or not this is anti-immigrant is a very secondary matter, but Real ID is a very bad policy, which is really bad for our nation. And unfortunately, Governor Spitzer decided to be the leader in implementing the Real ID, despite of the fact that we really have had 6 years to decide and implement the Real ID. But, you know, just by as I said, he has succumbed to misguided opposition and anti-immigrant rhetoric. So he has forsaken a practical policy just for his own short-sighted political cover. So today, actually, New Yorkers are really outraged at his flip-flopping, and New Yorkers are very ashamed to have a misleader like Governor Speicher as our governor.
Well, SJ, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for your time. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with S.J. Jung. He's the president of the Young Korean American Service and Education Center in New York. Coming up next, graffiti and a mystery at the L.A. River. Stay tuned.
Find your dreams come true. And I wonder if you know what it means, what it means. And I wonder if you know what it means, what it means. And I wonder if you know what it means to find your dreams. And I wonder.
I've been waiting all this my whole life, life.
And I want
these dreams be waking me up at night, night, night.
And I want
you say I think I'm never wrong, wrong.
And I want
you know what may be your right, right.
That's from Kanye West. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Aura Bogado. Friends of the LA River recently gained permits from the county and the city for artists to paint a large portion of the river walls near downtown LA. Graffiti writers from around the city gathered to create the largest production ever seen in Los Angeles, and some 1,000 people headed down to the river to witness it. Days after the production was finished, however, LA County Supervisor Gloria Molina expressed outrage over the murals. A longtime opponent of graffiti, Molina met with Friends of the River, or FOLAR, stating that she wanted the pieces whitewashed. A small portion of the wall space that was painted was not permitted, and FOLAR agreed that that portion could be painted over. However, a massive portion of the production was painted over last weekend. Molina's office has said that she didn't order the whitewashing, and it now remains a mystery who whitewashed the river. Meanwhile, local graffiti writers are organizing an open forum to address the city and county's permit policies, the whitewashing of the Arroyo Seco murals, and more. Painter and pioneer graph writer Chaz Bojorquez will give a historical overview and will approach the definitions of vandalism, tagging, graffiti, and art. Other panelists will also talk about how graffiti is used as a form of resistance and a tool with which to communicate struggle. The forum will take place on Saturday, November 17 at Crew West Gallery in downtown L.A. and will be moderated by gallery director and graph artist Man One. We're joined on the line by Lewis McAdams. He's a board member of the Friends of the L.A. River and in studio by Man One. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, thanks for letting us be on.
Lewis, I want to start with you. Talk a little bit about the process by which you got these permits to have this historic production done at Arroyo Seco.
We basically wanted to do this completely above board because that's the way Friends of the Los Angeles River always works. We have to work with the city and the county and the Corps of Engineers on an ongoing and fairly constant basis in the river channel for our river cleanups, the Gran Limpieza, and for our outdoor education days, river school days, and for all kinds of river walks. So we know exactly how to do these things, and we went about it in the usual way. We did site visits with the county and with the city. The Corps of Engineers doesn't control that part of the river, so we didn't have to ask them. The city council actually passed a resolution. Jose Huizar and Ed Reyes seconded it, supporting this project. So, and we saw it as several things. One, the Arroyo Seco Los Angeles River confluence is probably one of the most degraded and ugliest and most ill-used places on the entire Los Angeles River system. And for ever since Friends of the Los Angeles River started, which has been over 20 years, that's where we started Friends of the Los Angeles River, at that confluence, because we wanted to find probably the ugliest and most ill-used by humans place on the river, a place that was once a place of great natural beauty, a meeting of two year-round streams. And ever since then, people have been talking about restoring the confluence. Nothing has ever really come to fruition, and we saw this as the first chance to bring this part of the river back to life. And my 17-year-old son introduced me to Man One and Crew West Gallery, and it was obvious that they were an ideal partner to make this move. And we didn't see it as, you know, as any kind of defiance or any kind of rebellion or anything like that. We saw it as a chance to do something beautiful. Friends of the Los Angeles River itself is a 40-year artwork to bring the Los Angeles River back to life. And we saw this as exemplary action of the kinds of things that we support.
And Man One, you're here in studio, and I want to thank you so much for coming down. It's really an honor to have you here. I've known you for so many years, and I know we've had conversations in the past in terms of public space and graffiti as art. Can you talk about the historical significance? I mean, what did it mean to have so much wall space with which to get crews from all over L.A. and really around the world together to paint?
Right. Well, yeah, it truly was historic, and the way it came about, as Lewis said, was we met up and talked about doing something in the river. But at the same time, I was also talking to Meeting of Styles out of Germany, who produce, you know, these huge, large-scale events of mass gatherings of graffiti artists and just art lovers in general all over the world. And so they wanted to do one in Los Angeles. And they had contacted me to produce that. So this was that that event for LA. And, you know, we had over 200 artists there, you know, over 1,000 people, just families, kids, neighborhood people come and witness the, you know, the two-day event. And it was really beautiful. We had artists as young as 18 years old all the way to, you know, in their 40s. Who had been doing graffiti art for all these years. And, you know, people kept coming up to me and saying, wow, this is like the greatest event we've ever seen in L.A. For graffiti art. It's so peaceful. It's so well organized. The wall space is incredible. And, you know, so, yeah, it really was a totally historic event. And just to have it be such a great, positive event, and then afterwards find out that, you know, part of it has been removed, you know, is really heartbreaking. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it really seems like this mystery, right? Because I went down there yesterday, and this huge section is buffed. It's not like a tiny section. And then they go right up to Mir's mural, and they paint over part of it, and then it just kind of stops. And it's clear that it was contracted. I mean, it's the buffing that was done was probably done with a sprayer. It's huge.
Right.
I want to go back to Gloria Molina, and I want to pose this for Lewis as well. What was Molina's reaction to this? We know that she doesn't appreciate the aesthetic of graffiti. What was her response to this production being done, Lewis?
Well, she was furious. I mean, I had no idea what her position on murals were. You know, it was because it's the first time we've done something like that. She has not been historically one of the people that's worked more closely with Friends of the Los Angeles River. So we really don't have a whole lot of personal history. We got a call that from her office that the supervisor was going to be at our office in 1 hour, and so I called Mann, and I went over there myself. I mean, I'm the chairman of the board, so I don't work at full hour, but she came in with her chief of staff, Jerry Hertzberg, with Diego Cadena, who's I think number two or number three at the L.A. County Department of Public Works, and with a couple of other of her staffers. And it was clear that she wasn't there at our office to discuss this, but to order us to remove the murals. And we said no, and unfortunately, the meeting went downhill from there. I was stunned, actually. It's, you know, like I said, we've been working on the river for over two decades, and that was pretty much the most negative meeting I've ever had with a public official.
And she didn't state at that time that she definitely would whitewash it, and now she's denying that this whitewashing has occurred, correct?
Right. Well, we had agreed, as you said at the in your intro, that the I mean, you know, this may sound naive because I'm not inside this world, but you know, I think of murals and tagging as being two very different things. I mean, I think, you know, to me, murals are popular art, you know, and have been for, you know, thousands of years. And it was clear to me that Mrs. Molina doesn't see any difference between tagging or gangs or and artists working in this form. And that was surprising to me because, you know, it's essentially, and it was an aesthetic disagreement. They knew, they understood that we had done everything utterly legally in terms of getting permits and completely above board. And so they couldn't really attack us on that. So it really was a kind of an aesthetic judgment that what was happening, if it was painted in the Arroyo Seco channel, it was criminal activity. If that had happened at the county museum, it would have been art.
It seems criminal to me that this would even be whitewashed as much as it was.
Oh yeah, you know, and we had an agreement that we were going to take out whatever had happened after the 2 days because we had made an agreement that we would. This was a 2 day event, and I, you know, and I thought that Crew West and the other painters acted in a completely responsible. I mean, there was, you know, not a nozzle from a spray can left, and you know, everybody left, finished and their work and went on, and it was really thrilling, you know, and so to see what happened, and you know, I can't speak to the issue of who actually painted out the murals. You know, the county says that they didn't have anything to do with it. I have to take them at their word, although it's obvious that this was that this covering of the murals was done from a truck. I mean, to use
right.
this much paint, and you know, so that's all I can say. You know, we'd like to work with the county to find out who vandalized the murals.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Lewis McAdams. He's on the board of Friends of the LA River, and with Man One, he's a graffiti artist and a gallery owner. We're talking about this mystery about the whitewashing of hundreds of feet of permitted mural space at the LA River. Man One, unfortunately, we're starting to run out of time, but I do want to talk about this event that you're going to be moderating down at Crew West Gallery in downtown. Mm. Talk a little bit about the issues that you're going to be addressing there.
Yeah, well, the event we're having there, it's kind of ironic that we've already had this event scheduled for a few months now that this has happened, but it's perfect timing with what's going on with Los Angeles murals and the politics and everything. But basically, we're having a multi-generational panel of artists from Wayne Healy, you know, streetscapers, all the way down to, you know, young high school kids are going to be there. And, you know, as well as Chaz Bohorquez and very well-known artist of our time. And it's going to be a discussion about what's going on in L.A. with the murals. Ever since Siqueiros did the mural over in Alvera Street and it got whitewashed a few days later, there's been this repeated history of
murals.
That was
in 1932.
1932, right. And here we are, what, 75 years later, and it's still going on. So it's like, what's going on with the mural movement in Los Angeles? You know, we're no longer the mural capital of the world, and why not? You know, why are we losing that fight, you know? So basically it's like we're going to talk about all these issues that are coming up with muralism, with artists, with city, you know, politics and stuff like that.
And that event is called Resistance and Respect, a forum on the history of L.A. muralism and graph art, 1932 to 2007. That event's going to be taking place Saturday, November 17. It's from 2 to 6 p.m. It's a free event in downtown L.A. For more information, you can go to www.crewwest.com. That's CREWEST.com. Man One, thank you so much for coming in studio today.
Thank you, Oda.
Lewis McAdams, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Lewis McAdams. He's on the board of the Friends of the LA River and in studio by Crew West Gallery owner and graffiti artist Man One. And for Uprising's subversive thought of the day, I'd like to quote Gloria Anzaldúa, who once said, "I change myself, I change the world." That's Gloria Anzaldúa, and it's Uprising's subversive thought of the day. You have been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our producer, and Nadia Richardson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, which can be found by going to kpfk.org. From there, just click on Programs in the left column, scroll all the way down until you find our website. CDs of this program are available at www.pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. And for Sonali Kulhatkar, I'm your host and producer, Aura Bogado. Thanks so much for listening.